Hello, creative people. Welcome to Creative Conversations. My name is Hollis Citron, and we are so truly happy that you have chosen to spend this hour with us. So, a little background on the podcast. I am owner and founder of I Am Creative and Express Yourself Publishing. My mission is to expand that quote-unquote societal definition of creativity beyond a pencil and a paintbrush and empower people, especially adults, to own their talents that come in so many different forms. So I've created this space so that I can get to talk to people that have all different jobs, hobbies, and interests, and we get to have a conversation about their experiences and perspectives, all centered around three questions. One, how do you define creativity? Two, how do you incorporate it into your life? And three, why do you think it's important? Then we have a free-flowing conversation and we see where it goes from there. So I have had the honor to have spoken to entrepreneurs as young as 13, handwriting specialist, biologist, personal organizer, doctor, lawyer, and so many more. And the idea is that by sharing their stories, we get to explore the space of expressing yourself, giving yourself permission to take time for your interests and explore possibilities. And by doing all of this and incorporating it into your world daily, I promise you will feel more empowered, connected, and dare I say, happy. So, let me introduce my inspiring guest for today is
David Rothenberg. Now, you have to pardon my reading your bio because I may mess up on names. So I'm just saying it in advance. It's not, I don't mean anything to be rude. So David Rothenberg is a musician and philosopher. He wrote Why Birds Sing, Bug Music, Survival of the Beautiful, and many other books published in at least 11 languages. Rothenberg is a distinguished professor of philosophy and music at NJIT. He has performed or recorded with Pauline Oliveros, Peter Gabriel, Ray Fiery, Suzanne Vega, Scanner, Elliot Sharp, Iva Vitova, and the the College of Percussion. That's where I said I apologize for butchering names. So, welcome to the space, David. I am so happy to have you here.
Thanks.
So, David, after reading your bio, that's short based off of all the amazing things you've done, can you give us a little bit more information about who you are before we dive into the questions?
Yeah, basically, I'm a musician and writer and philosopher interested in the natural world and communicating with the natural world, often by making music together with animals and the sounds of nature live and in the studio, and writing books about this. And then as a professor, I'm teaching like all kinds of stuff on culture and technology. I teach at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, teaching kind of engineering, business, computer students, all the non-technical stuff, like how to pay attention to beauty in the world and to be creative and do things that don't immediately seem pragmatic like the rest of their education.
Yeah, yeah. So as I was watching one of your videos, it's so important, the whole connection between the art and the sciences, which is exactly what you're saying, is you're opening them up to a different way of seeing, a different way of listening. So important, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one great thing about teaching at technical universities, if you're teaching the non-technical stuff, you could do anything. You could be completely crazy and far out, and they let you do it because they just are focusing on other stuff. And they say that the humanities and arts side of the education, we can go for anything. You know, you be free to explore and not be hemmed in by what people might think you're supposed to do in those programs. So I really like teaching there because I have a lot of freedom to try unusual things out.
Yeah, which is where we're really going to get to dive into the space. I heard you on NPR and talking about playing with the cicadas and your inspiration, you know, how long you've had kind of a relationship with them, the cicadas. You were born in the year of the cicada.
Yeah, I was born in one of the cicada years, not this particular brood, but brood two, which comes out like all of these groups every 17 years. So that was 1962 when I was born. And so 62 and, 79 and then 96, and then 2004 and 2013. These were the cicada years of Brood 2. And each over the years, I got more interested in music and nature. And as we converged upon 2013, Brood 2, that year I said, I'm going to write a book about bug music, about how humans learned our love of rhythm and noise by paying attention to insects. Kind of a radical claim, but that was the story. And now we have this other brood, Brood X, Brood 10, this year. There's been so much interest in it. I said, okay, I can't stay away from these cicadas. We have to go back and do more. What can I do with cicadas that I haven't already done? Of course, cicadas in their millions as musicians and as a phenomenon are inexhaustible. There's always more to do with them. The main thing I've done differently this time is got more different musicians together with me to play with them, just to see what would happen. How would they react? How would they be transformed by this experience? So that's what I've been doing the last few weeks.
Yeah, that's what got me so excited, like listening to this. It's like going out and actually being an active listener. You're being a participant and a listener to listen to the music. It's their language, it's their communication, and you're going and being a participant either alone or bringing other people along for the ride and just being spontaneous and seeing what's created. It's just amazing.
Yeah, that you've explained it very well there. I mean, the idea, at first it just sounds like noise and people will say, what a crazy thing to do. What are you even possibly doing with all this noise? But it takes like 2 minutes to listen to this and explain to people what's happening, and you hear already, right away, how interesting it is and what can be derived from this. It doesn't take long to realize it's interesting. Even though at first it's just like a lot of noise, people think you're crazy.
Well, I heard you describe it as there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, like an emotional statement of sound.
Yeah, in terms of an individual cicada sound, that's absolutely right. And as an example of that, I would talk about the annual cicadas that you have every year that we're going to hear in summer, starting now and going on into August. A single cicada of that type makes so much noise. And they'll start by like, and then they'll just stop. And often people hear this sound and say, what a bunch of crazy noise is that? I wish they would shut up. I can't focus or concentrate. But if you pay attention to just that sound, and if you make an image out of it, like scientists like to do, they make these things called sonograms, pictures of the sound, mapping the frequency against time. I think the most beautiful of all sonograms is the sound of one of those cicadas. And that's where you hear there's a beginning, middle, and end. It's this beautiful, very clearly structured thing. It's not just noise. Now, these periodic cicadas, the ones that come out every 17 years, we are lucky that each individual one is really quiet. Like the most common sound made by these guys is called the pharaoh sound. They go like, pharaoh, pharaoh. And they're not so individually so loud. But lucky for them, per acre, there's millions of them. So it makes this huge wash of sound. And these little pharaoh sounds, if you multiply it by the hundreds, the thousands, the millions, all you hear is a drone, like the tail disappears. Instead of ew, ew, you just hear. So then you have this drone, this tone just resounding in the trees. Yeah. And then you overlap with the world of human music around the world based on drones, most famously Indian music. There's a drone behind everything. One tone just playing and playing, and that the ragas that are based on this kind of improvise and follow very particular rules, melodies going up, down, all around, but that constant drone is just going along. So start out playing with cicadas, it's like you're playing along with a drone. It's a very common human musical idea. Mm-hmm. That's the first of the many cicada sounds.
Oh my God, there's like a whole education within cicada world.
Absolutely. We do nothing else.
We could have
Every time I hear them, I realize like, oh, I've done this so many times, but it sounds totally different now than ever before. Why is that? It doesn't sound like anything I remember. Mm-hmm. It's always great to do it again and feel like it's a fresh and new thing like you've never heard before.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, that's really within everything. I mean, I can speak within, you know, the visual arts and things that I've done. It's like I've created things that are similar. I've done it before, but it's always different because it's a different moment in time. It's a different, my mind is in a different place. The materials, even though they might be kind of similar, are being utilized in a different way because I'm different. So, yeah, it's that change, which I think is so beautiful. The awareness of it.
Yeah, for some people, what's most important is to keep doing it. Just keep making something else, seeing where it goes without planning. And like many musicians I know, constantly performing and recording, especially this past year when you can't go anywhere or do anything in person, people have been making music, just recording it, producing it on their own. And then what do? You send it out into the world where everyone already knows there's too much music. There's more than we could ever get around to listening to. And yet people still need to make more. Cannot be stopped. Like the making itself is of value and sharing it with other people. And maybe even if no one listens to it, just the making of it teaches you so much.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, so let's dive in because this is going to be a very deep conversation. So we're going to start with our Would You Rather, and then we'll dive into the first question. And I just first want to acknowledge the people that are here live. Thank you so much for being here. Please feel free to put any questions or comments into the chat box below and we will see them. So, David, would you rather look at everything from far away with binoculars or look at tiny things close up with a microscope?
I would like to look at things close up, either through the microscope or through the telescope. So either distant giant things brought closer or tiny things brought closer. And it is true, these days I spend a lot of time looking at tiny things magnified, made bigger and bigger and bigger, because I'm amazed the detail you can find in things that at a distance you might forget are there and you want to get closer.
Yeah, totally agreed. When you really get a chance to see all of that, yeah. It's like, wow.
Yeah, not to distract you from the line of questionings, but yesterday morning I was walking, you know, from my house down to the river, and I saw on a path an animal that I thought, like, this doesn't even exist. What is that thing? It was a tortoise shell colored fox.
Oh my gosh.
I said, what is that? That doesn't even exist. So I went back and looked up, typed in tortoise shell fox, and like nothing. You're like, okay, what did I see? You look at pictures and red foxes, gray foxes. But then when I typed in coyote, I learned that a coyote can come in any possible color, just about.
Wow.
So it probably was a thin, small coyote because they come in all colors. And that was like, you know, who knows? Maybe I still made it up. I wasn't close enough. If I could get closer, then I would have. Because I always like when taking a walk and coming back, saying what like people I've met who are, you know, from different native peoples would often say, like, oh, you're back. Did you see any animals? Mm-hmm. I always ask my wife that when she comes back from running, do you see any animals? She says, what are you talking about? Why are you even asking that question? But there are a lot of animals you can see, like this made up thing that doesn't even exist that I saw that was probably a coyote.
Well, it does exist.
I could talk about that and I could have those conversations for hours, different animals people claim to have seen and when they came, when they went. I think it has to do with creativity, but I'm not sure how. I think it does. Coyotes are, of course, very creative. We all know that.
Well, I think that, what was I going to say? I just had this thought and it just flew out of my head. But
yeah,
I'm
sorry to go on this tangent.
No, this is good. That's what this is about. Yeah. Like this space is literally about us. If we were sitting across a table on the couch, having a conversation, like that's what it's about. And, what you saw was obviously real. It was a three-dimensional object that was walking in space. But what is, like, when we had our pre-conversation, I love the fact that you just kind of dive into things. And even though this doesn't have, like, a definition, you didn't go and see a picture of it, you're going to give it some kind of a name or a title. And in our pre-conversation, you were like, well, I was wondering what it was like to hear what it sounds like underwater. So I asked people who you thought would be in that area of expertise, and they were like, we don't know. And you're like, well, I want to find out.
Yeah, that's after I made this recording. Yeah, I made this recording of, I had always heard over the years recordings of underwater pond sounds. You stick a microphone in a pond, it's a waterproof, it's called a hydrophone, and you listen, it's always sounded like weird electronic music, like what is that? And I hadn't paid much attention until recently, and then I started listening, and the things were really strange. And so that's when I sent my recording to the world expert on this phenomenon, Jérôme Sawyer, at the Museum of Natural History in Paris. What am I listening to? And he said, oh, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? This is what you study. Yeah, I do study this, but I have no idea. And he said, actually, scientists, and we know about 10% of the sounds you could hear in a pond, 90% of them are unknown. And that just seemed so astonishing to me, because we're talking about something that's right in our backyards, ordinary ponds, very easy to listen to, technology is not very obscure, and we still don't know what's there. And that started me on this long trajectory, which I'm in the middle of right now, trying to write a book on this. Even just yesterday, I was listening to this pond and heard some sound that nothing like anything I've ever heard anywhere. While I was sitting explaining to someone, like, you know, you really have to spend time. Nothing happens for a while. Maybe something's going to happen. And then we just heard this thing that was just so odd. Like, okay, I've never heard anything like that. I don't know what it is.
What did it sound like?
It sounded like, usually you're hearing crackly sounds, which are plants kind of exchanging oxygen with the air, like photosynthesis, and the little rhythms, like a whole electronic uneven rhythms. And then insects will make little gestures like, and then maybe in rhythm, or maybe you'll hear something high sound like things like you might hear above ground, like crickets and mosquitoes, but they're not actually heard at all above ground. But this was a very complex, long series of rumbles, like, sort of like that. Very strange. And it was a good example of what I was trying to explain, because we're going to do a concert with these underwater pond sounds. And I was warning this woman organizing the event that perhaps nothing will happen. There'll be no sound. But if you wait, maybe something will happen. Yeah. And if nothing happens, we can always play back sounds recorded in the same site another day. Mm-hmm, when you're dealing with nature, you often have to just wait. Not with cicadas, because when they're out, there's millions of them. But almost every other interaction with nature, you're searching for, you know, the creature or the moment or the place. So it takes more time than a lot of people want to spend. Cicadas are great because they're just... they're all around. Once you go there, there's so much to see. Millions of them, they're doing all kinds of stuff. They're making all these sounds. That's why the media loves them. They can just show up and have something to film.
Right.
Waiting all day. Rather than nature, making nature programs, you're waiting for a month before these flies emerge from the water. Like, the amount of effort to make these things is very different than surrounded by a swarm of cicadas that comes out on schedule.
So. Interesting. Yeah, really the patience and the listening. It's, so we're going to dive into the question, but I want to acknowledge Angela saying this feels like John Cage listening to silence.
Yeah, John Cage had a big influence on me. Certainly when I first read his book, Silence, which everyone should read, it's not just about silence. It's about being an artist, being creative. I think I was probably finishing high school or starting college when I read that. And the book is written in this abstract poetic style. And he talked about how when he was studying, trying to decide what to do, all of his teachers were kind of demanding something from him that he didn't want to give. He thought about studying architecture. He went to see to study with a famous architect who I believe was actually named Goldfinger. I think that's true. And he said, oh, you want to be an architect? You must devote yourself totally to architecture. And he said, well, you know, I'm also interested in other things like music. Maybe I should do that. And he went to study with Arnold Schoenberg, the great composer. Yes, Cage, to become a composer, you must have an innate feeling for harmony and what it means. And he said, well, I don't really have that feeling. Maybe I shouldn't be a musician. He just, whatever they told him you had to have, he said, I don't have that. I just have to go somewhere else. And so that made a big impression on me, because I was interested in a lot of stuff, and people were always trying to get complete devotion out of you to whatever their field was. Mm-hmm. And the opposite view is actually often worth considering. You don't have to be obsessed with one thing. You don't have to just practice, you know, 10 hours a day for 5 years, like Malcolm Gladwell says in one of his books, or Amy Chua, the Tiger Mother. You know, the first 5 hours of piano practice, those are the easy ones. You don't have to be like that. You just explore, see what happens, go in different directions. And probably the most interesting things happen when you're not looking for something to happen. You don't expect anything. That's where the surprise emerges.
It's where the beauty is. Love it. Okay, so let's get your definition of what creativity is. So how would you define creativity?
You know, I don't have an exact definition ready for this question, but I would say creativity is, you know, looking at the situation you're in, taking in all the possibilities, and coming up with something to do that's a surprise to yourself and to everyone else there. You do just what's unexpected. Mm-hmm. And that's when I know that whenever I'm reading a book or watching a film, or I feel like I got it all figured out, I like to second guess everything, I start to get bored. But when something surprising happens, I go, wow, that was, I didn't expect that. And that, you know, and if it's a good surprise, it puts everything together in a way you didn't expect and makes something you didn't think was there. Like from the noise of cicadas, bringing humans together, making a music out of it you didn't think you were going to make, changing your own sense of what's possible by virtue of, you know, not being prepared or not knowing. Rather than, you know, musicians who are good at this show up, they don't just play their own music, they change their music because of where they are and what is happening. And not everyone is like that. There's enough people who just do their thing wherever it is. And there's others who are ready to adapt. And so creativity is surprising yourself and the audience with making something out of what you've been given that no one thought was possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I love what you're touching on with the adaption and flexibility. That's what I'm hearing is flexibility and openness, as opposed to this is what I do. These are the chords I play. These are the sets that I do, and I don't go beyond that. And don't expect anything more of me because this is my comfort level and this is where I am. Whereas there's the other where it's just complete openness and like, okay, let's see what's going to happen. There's fear in that, isn't there?
Absolutely. And people often misinterpret it. You know, they look at like John Cage and they'll think, you know, what, this guy's just, instead of composing music, he just says, just listen to what's around you. And like, he, there's just nothing to it. It's like, you know, it's masquerading as an idea and there's no idea. But actually, if you pay attention to what he actually said and wrote and the music he created. This guy was really a careful creator of many different things and a real artist and a real teacher that I was glad to have met him a few times and to have gotten to know him a little bit. I remember, I think right when I first met him at some seminar he was teaching in Finland, he was giving a talk and some music critic in the audience was outraged and said, "Why, Mr. Cage, if we follow what you're thinking, you know, we're not going to be able to enjoy Mozart." And he said, "Well, I don't know. I think if you could listen to me and also Mozart, sure, and maybe even Beethoven." Mm-hmm. That was his answer, like, which was very subtle because there was, you know, that in paying attention to Cage and his answer, you'd learn something important about the difference between Mozart and Beethoven. And about pronouncements of any aesthetic kind, saying this can be done, this can't be done.
So tell me a little bit more about that. How do you see them being, explain to me more the differences between them.
So Mozart and Beethoven?
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, Cage is like both of them. You know, Mozart was very, you know, fluid. He just turned music out, it just came out of him. It was like perfect. He never needed to revise anything. It was kind of, you know, and very perfect, exact, likable. Everyone gets along with it. Beethoven was a tortured character, constantly redoing things, breaking all the rules I remember, you know, taking music classes where you're not supposed to have parallel fifths in harmony. That's supposed to be like, you know, too cheesy and bad. And when you learn rules of harmony, but everyone knew Beethoven said, what, parallel fifths are forbidden? Well, I allow them. And of course, the theme of his most famous symphony is completely absurd. It's exactly not how you can have a theme. You can't have a symphony begin da-da-da-dum. It's just so off. It breaks all the rules as it starts, and it's the most recognizable piece of classical music that anybody would say. And maybe it's just because its time has come, it's been used so much. But no, I think that by breaking the rules as to what counts a theme, how you can build a large piece of music, he just showed us, like, you know, I can surprise and make something out of it. You know, I wasn't thinking about this, but it's a good example of what I said before.
Yeah.
You know, you want to get yourself into the mood of Beethoven's time where you go to hear the symphony, and that's how it begins. It's just so, so, so shocking. Mm-hmm. And so surprising. And it's not just a surprise. It goes on. There's a Haydn surprise symphony that just has a surprising note that wakes you up if you're falling asleep. But Beethoven's Fifth Symphony is like, from the beginning, just twisting all that what you thought what was possible. And of course, it's so familiar now, it's kind of hard to put yourself into that vein. It's like Louis Armstrong in West End Blues. He made this recording in 1927, I think, where he just plays a chorus of this blues piece going, ba ba ba. And he just holds out this one note longer than you would think would be musically useful, just showing like, hey, I don't have to play a lot. I can just do this. And that was a shock at the time. And, you know, that's also a lot has been written about that piece and that thing I'm saying now, that it just was so shocking. You have to get yourself into the mood, what it would be like to be shocked by that sound. Because we've heard so much, it seems like nothing can shock us now, but we have to. Once you start to listen very closely, almost anything can be shocking and surprising. And thus anything can become the beginning of something creative by just paying attention where you thought that there was nothing there.
Yeah, the word that was coming to me was kind of uncomfortable, that it kind of makes people feel uncomfortable because of that shock.
In a good sense or like an uneasiness?
It could be either way, kind of like just the fact that Beethoven was doing something different and people are like, what? You're not supposed to start it that way. That makes me feel in a certain way like that's not the norm. It's not the expectation, like you're saying about shocking. It's not the expectation. So it could be this unease or, a twist from the expectation. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute. That really got my attention. And that's kind of brilliant.
Yeah, like my son, who's 22, he makes this kind of music called hyperpop. It's like a new genre of extremely noisy, very short pop songs that like 20-year-olds, some of them like. And it's breaking all the rules, like all kinds of digital distortion. You're not supposed to use songs that have like, you know, no structure, but they kind of, and it's a kind of, you know, every generation of pop music has to do something that upsets the adults and they think it's just off and wrong. It's just the nature of these changing tastes. And we can still be shocked. Earlier I said, oh, we've heard it all. Nothing is shocking, but it's not really true.
Yeah. So tell me about when you were younger. Like, were you always playing music or when did this
journey start? I started playing music when little kids tend to, like in fourth grade or third grade, you learn the recorder.
Yes.
Interestingly, the instrument, one thing I didn't know until recently is that instrument's called the recorder, right? And the reason, and the tape recorder is named after the recorder, the wind instrument, because the recorder was got that name because record means to learn, like in Latin. And the idea is it's so easy to play, you can learn stuff with it. Before there was recording, like audio recording, there was recording on the recorder because it was so easy to play.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that weird that the tape recorder, the digital recorder, is based on this instrument? Yeah. So anyway, I learned the recorder in third grade or so. And then fifth grade, I started playing clarinet. And then I think when I was in junior high, I started getting in more unusual things, kinds of jazz music, starting to hear about it. One reason was that I grew up in this town in Connecticut in Westport. It had a famous jazz record shop and they had a lot of weird records there. There's actually quite a few very well-known jazz musicians who got interested in music by going to that store. which was there until just a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it has a history, and these places, you know, these opportunities to learn about things that otherwise are out of reach are very important. Of course, now we have no excuse. You can get online and learn about anything. So anyone who thinks that all the music on the radio sounds the same, or everything you see is same, look somewhere else. There's something else out there. You know, yeah. If you think that all photos on Instagram look identical, don't look at those pictures. Look somewhere else. There's so much other stuff up there, you know, and it's very easy to feel like it's all identical and boring and repetitive, but just go elsewhere. There are other things around.
Yeah,
no
agreed.
Excuse. We have no excuse for getting bored.
Yeah, yeah. It's a choice. It's a choice. You can stay in the sameness and just be like, this is what's presented to me. And this is what I see. And these are the thoughts I have that it all looks the same. Or like you're saying, go look someplace else. Like yeah. Be active about it. Be an active participant in your life and the choices that you make.
Yeah.
So you did jazz. So this is like middle school. So in high school, you're continuing, I guess.
In high school, I was, you know, kind of a nerdy kid. I wanted to be different than other people. Most of my friends in high school, they were either into math and science and computers. Of course, a computer was a different thing in those days. And either that or they were the kind of shaggy rock musicians. Mm-hmm. Would be smoking pot behind Building Nine and then having his weird bands. And it's interesting, all the things that people have gone on to do. Like one of my friends kind of became his idols. You know, he joined one of these famous rock bands that he listened to all the time. He replaced the guy who he
did.
Was
he really?
Famous. Yeah.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. And cool. Yeah, Mark Herman, the guitarist.
Okay.
Like the band was perhaps Foreigner or something like that. And then, you know, you can actually become your heroes. It does happen. And mm-hmm. so yeah. And then I was also, you know, interested in math and science. And so I was, you know, when I went to college, I thought I would go into math or science, something also connecting to nature. I was very interested in the environment, saving the earth, things like that. But then I kind of found my own path, which was in between everything. And also at college, my favorite professors were all the iconoclasts who didn't quite fit in. Many of these people became professors in the 1960s, where everything was much looser and more open. So they're the kind of people who would have a hard time getting work in today's universities with all their rigorous requirements and mm-hmm. things like that. And so these people I gravitated to because they were all in between. So I learned a mishmash of in between things. And looking back, sometimes I think I should have stuck to one or two specific disciplines, got more basic training in anything, but instead I just drifted off in my own directions. And that's what I continued to do.
Yeah, it's kind of where your soul really wants to go. I mean, you got into this amazing teaching position within the sciences. So here you were interested in this when you were younger. You were interested in music when you were younger, which is what you're doing now. And all of these different, this job allows you to really dive in. You've worked, collaborated with incredible people. You've done so many amazing things based off of, you know, from me just listening, from you, from discovery, from this wanting, from this curiosity space.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I often tell people who are, you know, looking for positions. So I applied for 150 jobs after I got my PhD in philosophy and only got one interview and one job. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody was interested. I'd done all these creative things. I'd published books, but they were on topics that they weren't seen as of mainstream interest. I'd done all this stuff, but still it wasn't like people were beating down the door saying, we'd love to have you come work here. It was really hard. And mm-hmm. I was pretty sure when I got this interview and later this job, at that point, I was pretty sure I'd be doing something else to earn money, some other kind of job, either working in the computer industry because I had been working there writing for different tech companies, or else work in environmental consulting of some kind. I figured I was, you know, this academic world, what didn't have a place for me. It was just like at the last moment when, you know, this opportunity came up, but I pretty much thought that it wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the happy little surprises.
That's right. You never know. And also I got this job at a school I'd never heard of. I knew nothing about. It turned out to be a very good place to work because they'd given me a lot of freedom. And so I often tell people, you don't necessarily want to be at these most famous high-powered schools. They might demand more of you than you want to give to them, especially if you have these creative ideas about doing your own kinds of stuff.
Yeah, totally agreed. Okay, so let's dive into question number two.
This is only question two. You have to shut me up if I'm going off the deep end. Say no. Come on, focus.
This is
focus.
Good. Yeah. This is. Yeah. We're leading in really good directions, and I think it's flowing together really nicely.
Right.
So how do you incorporate creativity? Obviously, we know music and all this, but is there any else you want to expand on how you incorporate creativity into your own life?
You mean outside of work, like life in general?
Yeah.
You know, I try to do things that cut through the possibility of boredom or being depressed about everything being the same. I think like many people, like most people, and especially over the past year, sometimes you feel like it's just all going nowhere. It's the same. Nothing's really happening. You know, that tendency, I think, is in all of us. I have the tendency, despite sounding very optimistic right here in this conversation, to get very depressed about doing the same stuff and feeling like no one's paying attention to all this stuff. You know, I have that side too. So to counter that, you have to surprise yourself by trying things you didn't expect. Over the past year, I spent a lot of time collaborating online with people I've never met in person. We just spent hours making music together, collaborating texts and videos and things. People I've never actually met in person. And they're like giving up my traditional sense of control, saying I'm doing it all my way. Like, let's see what someone else has to say. I don't want to decide everything anymore. I used to more. I'd rather build on people's different expertise. I would like to relinquish more and more control over projects and ideas and directions so that they become much more cooperative and collective. So
how did that feel?
It's great. It's always fun. And, you know, just to open up and see what can someone else do with this, even if it's not, you know, sometimes I want to have it be my vision and my choice, but not always. And I'm increasingly excited when other people's approaches go in and I see what they bring to it.
So this is something that's been on the newer side. The
I'd say
collaboration.
It's more recently, yeah. Or the idea is some people would criticize me, like he wants total control of everything, like, you know. But I know that there's many areas where other people know more than me about things, and I would rather learn from their expertise. I don't have to control everything, and many people I know over the past year have also talked about how the more collaborative the projects are, the more they're finding them rewarding and worthwhile, particularly over a period where there's been so much enforced isolation.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think it's so much about the connection. People want to have dialogue. They want to have to listen, to have that connect, the word connection. They just want to connect. And I think it's important. It's a life force. In certain aspects, I've realized how controlling I can be on things. I think I'm thinking like more so, this is kind of a silly, doesn't have to relate to anything, but like driving, like our daughter still doesn't have her driving, her driver's license, because I will fully admit being a passenger in a car is not very easy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when you're not driving, you just have to tune out, and it can be. Yes, I'm aware of that. I mean, some things I've been involved in are inherently collaborative, like playing music is always collaborative. Making films is extremely collaborative. It takes so many people to do that. Writing books, on the other hand, is usually seen as an individual activity. But even that is more collaborative than people imagine when you think of the work of editors and designers and publishers and publicists. Like the book is not just the words. It's this whole nexus of things.
Yeah. There's a lot of people within the process. I know within the multi-author books that I create, that's a very collaborative process, because it's each person having their portion and then coming together under the umbrella of a topic. So,
Right. And what does the editor do? How much does the editor curate the contributions? How much do they just sort of throw it out there?
So anything else that you want to add for ways that you incorporate creativity into your world?
It depends how many more questions you have. Make
Just
sure
one
you get to
more.
them all. Just
One
one
more.
more, then we have time. Let's see. I try and one reason to counter this sense that I can look at my own work and say, well, this guy Rothenberg is actually a pretty limited artist and thinker. He's always doing the same stuff. It's always like communicating using music to communicate with the natural world. So the same, like but then whenever I do the same things again, they're totally different. It's always worth doing them, even if you've already done that exact thing. Just do it again. As you said earlier in this conversation, it's not going to be the same. It's going to be different in ways you don't expect. And so but with that in mind, I decide I don't mind repeating the same things because they will go in directions you don't expect.
I think that's kind of like an underlying theme throughout this conversation is the shocking, just going in directions that you don't expect, even with that kind of sameness. As I was listening to some more things that you were more videos and things, is it's just that whole it just goes back to the listening. It's like the animal world and why these birds, why a nightingale makes a certain sound and why another bird makes another sound in their communication, and they have like longer cadences and shorter cadences, and it's just amazing. I was listening and I was just transfixed. I was like, it's so true. It's just beautiful.
I'm glad, yeah. And one thing that people are talking about the work that I'm doing, sometimes they think it's all like a joke, like, oh, he plays music with bugs, like, and that, sometimes I have to tell them, look, I'm actually serious about this. I'm serious in the sense that I think interesting work can come from this activity. Like, I'm making music with cicadas because I think the music is going to be interesting, not just that the idea is interesting. It's not conceptual art. It's like, it's actually an artistic practice. And so sometimes they're a little put off by that. And then I say one of the things I do to emphasize my seriousness about this is I write these books, and the books delve into the science, the poetry, the history, the music, the experience of interacting with the natural world in an artistic, in an aesthetic way. And one thing I keep saying as a kind of overarching theme is that it's not like science is more accurate about what's going on in nature than music or than poetry or anything else. And that human beings have so many different ways of learning about the world, so many ways of knowing. And we have the fullest understanding of anything around us. If we combine them all, we acknowledge they're going to say different things. We need them all. One doesn't remove the need for the other. You can't just say science is more accurate about what cicadas are doing than someone who's playing music with them. They take a different approach to the phenomenon, and they're going to come up with different answers. If you want to be the most educated about what's going on, you have to use both. You have to say, well, scientists might say this, a poet might say this. They're both out there. They both must be acknowledged simultaneously.
Agreed. Yeah, majorly agreed. Because if you're only speaking from one side, it's like, well, I know I've studied all of this and I know that this is the way it is. And then insert, it's like, well, have you done anything about it? Like, have you physically done besides studying? Have you done anything about it? Well, no, but I've studied this. You need all of it.
Exactly.
You need to be in it. So, any else to expand? Do you like skydiving? Do you like dancing? Do you like, is there anything else to add to the mix before we go to the third question?
Who doesn't like dancing? I heard something yesterday. I can't remember where it was exactly. Someone was talking about their life, and at some point they said, I realized I could either be angry or I could dance. I knew I had to dance, so I had to stop being angry.
True. You don't stay angry once you start moving your body,
Right.
do you?
I needed to dance, so the anger had to be lifted at that moment.
Yeah. I have to say, I would be really self-conscious before until I kind of made the move of really just kind of relinquishing my teaching, you know, career and moving into my newer area of my company, mm-hmm. I was self-conscious. I wouldn't dance so much. I was very self-conscious of my movements, and also wouldn't want a camera on me. I would never think that I'd have a podcast. I mean, it was just a totally different, much more self-consciousness.
Yeah, I noticed this time I had different people shooting video and all these TV crews with cicadas. And so when there was footage of me, it's like, I don't want to look at that too much. I don't want to become more self-conscious of what I look like here. I see that maybe I should have been more self-conscious in these particular scenes, but you know, I guess it doesn't matter. It's someone else's problem. I shouldn't worry too much about what I look like doing these things. Someone else can worry about that. I'm too much interested in the doing itself.
I think that's a very important point to make, though, because I get that way too. I just shot a video for something that I put onto my website, and I didn't do my makeup and I didn't do my hair. I was in the moment and I wanted to say what I wanted to say in that moment. I went back and looked at the video. I'm like, that's not the most flattering. Like, I could have made myself look better, but I still put it up. I'm like, you know what? That's what it is. Cause it was the doing. And I think it's very important not to get caught up in all the other stuff.
Yeah, we also have kind of strange expectations of what things are supposed to look like on video. Like, watch news programs in other countries besides the United States. Everyone looks more normal. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of easier to trust someone speaking, reading the news to you if they look like a normal person instead of like a kind of a news face, you know, Hollywood version of a person. Like, why do we need that? If people, you know, people can be themselves. We've seen all kinds of stuff. You don't need the media to look better than real life. It has to reflect real life in its own mediated way.
Yeah. Because I think definitely trust. Yeah, it's important. You feel it's relatable. It's not like something higher than you, like way higher than you. But anyway, okay. So let's dive into question number 3, which kind of wraps everything up in a nice little bow. As to why do you think creativity is important?
Creativity is important because it's what keeps you from being stuck in the grind and from being bored and feeling like nothing new is possible. It is what enables you to create something unforeseen out of what you've been given, out of what's happening. Do something different than what you did before. Mm-hmm. And that the possibility is always there to go another way. You know, it's like Robert Frost, two roads diverged in a yellow wood. I took the one less traveled by. That's made all the difference. But like, there's not just one road. There's hundreds of possibilities. You can make your own path straight to the forest. You can turn around. You know, that would be a good assignment in some school literature class. Write a different choice. Instead of the two roads diverging in the wood, what else could you do? What else could happen here? So many other things. Mm-hmm. And that there's always something you could try you haven't tried that you might think is a bad idea and just see where it goes. And I feel like I'm constantly trying different things. Many of them don't lead places I want to go back to, but sometimes they do. And I'm constantly looking for something else. Mm-hmm. But maybe in that constant looking, I always do consistent things. I'm not sure. Because earlier I said, like, all the stuff I'm doing is kind of similar. I often find, I'll pick some book I wrote many years ago and read some passages, and they're just the same things I'm thinking about now. And then I think, like, boy, I said it much better then. What am I doing? I thought I was improving.
Getting more clarity.
Which makes me think of something that's part of this book I'm working on now, which was when I started wanting to write books in my 20s, and I came up with these ideas and would go talk to agents and editors and publishers, they would say, like, oh, this is great. You want to talk about all and everything. You want to explain the world. Like, yeah, you certainly are a philosopher, but you know, you should wait until you've lived a few decades, many years before you have real life experience. And then you can sit down and make your pronouncements on all and everything. And now that I'm older, you know, in my late 50s and having done all this stuff, I have no desire to explain everything and make grand pronouncements. Instead, I want to listen to the mysterious, very specific underwater sounds of a pond and delve into this most specific experience, exactly what people were telling me I should have been doing decades ago. Now I should be talking about big, universal topics. I don't want to do it.
But isn't that interesting?
Maybe they were wrong. Yeah, and of course, in the process, the book will have to, by delving in and focusing on something so singular and specific, will end up becoming universal on its own. That's what I hope, at least universal enough so you and everyone else out there might want to read a book on this very obscure topic, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, already people are saying, like, why would you want to publish this? No one's going to want to read this. It's so obscure. It's the most obscure, least marketable idea you've ever come up with. It's like, okay, that's why I'm going to do it.
Right.
I'm going to do it. I don't really care. I don't really care. I feel like I'm doing it because it needs to be done.
Yeah.
You know, that I'm not even in control. This just has to be done. It's finding its own essence. It's not easy to do. It's not like it goes along in some kind of flow state. It's like a lot of work. But I just feel like I don't feel like I pick my projects necessarily. They kind of arrive and then I follow them. And, you know, some of them never get done, but most of them emerge eventually. And tell me your question one more time. It was about why creativity is important. Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Yeah. So creativity is important because it enables you to take these possible sources of inspiration, find out whether they can actually be realized. Without creativity, the possibility of a good idea is just going to die an early death before it arrives. But with a sense of creativity, you say, maybe that could lead somewhere. Maybe that could become something. Mm-hmm. And again, the surprise that something might come of this is what interests me.
Surprise exploration. So listeners, we challenge you. Surprise. Like, go for that surprise. Explore. Kind of take that road untraveled and kind of see where it leads. You could be really happily surprised. There's the shock, the awe, the process. It's just do it. Just do it. So before you, David, kind of tell everybody how they can find out more about you, I just want to know, is it possible that after I say my spiel, that you can leave us with some music?
Yeah, is it going to work on this call? Yeah, I can play something live here.
Okay. Sure. So if you could tell people how to connect with you, I'll say my spiel, and then we'll kind of close out with you playing music.
Sure, yeah. You know, like anyone else, you can just type my name into your computer, you'll find out all kinds of things I've done. You can go to my website, davidrothenberg.net. You could listen to my music wherever you listen to music, whatever sources you prefer. Videos can be found all over the place. But to actually learn, if you're really interested in what I'm doing, just pick any of these things and pay attention to whatever it is you find. Spend some time with it.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what people often don't do. I saw a nice cartoon from The Onion the other day saying, best friend opens up, album you spent 5 years making and skims through the songs in 5 minutes. Great, you know. That's what people do. Why don't people do that? There's so much else to listen to. At some point, if anything interests you, spend enough time with it to see if it might transform and surprise you.
I love that. Yeah,
I don't know if that's innocent or cranky advice. I'm not sure.
No, it's like this ADH world of AD, whatever. You know what I'm saying? ADH, uh-huh. This world that we have, where we have to like jump from thing to thing to thing. Everybody has the attention span of like a flea.
Yeah.
Actually spend time and actually learn about it and dive into it, and not just go from thing to thing to thing. So no, I totally get it. So. David, it has been so wonderful spending this hour speaking with you. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. So now we're going to imagine I was in Berlin playing along with the nightingale. The nightingale starts to sing. Maybe you hear him. I hear him. I don't know about you.
Yeah, you hear it. Yeah. We hear it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. What a beautiful way to close this out. This space is all about inspiring, connecting, and sharing stories. So please like, follow, and share so we can spread this word out and just spread the goodness, because we need to lift each other up. So again, thank you, David. Thank you, listeners, for joining live and listening to the replay. I wish you a good morning, good afternoon, and good evening wherever you are in this world. So goodbye, everybody.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you. So glad you were here. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Feeling inspired? There are so many ways to do things for you, to get yourself moving, to get your creative juices flowing, and to have fun. Check out I Am Creative and Express Yourself Publishing. Go to iamcreativephilly.com. I am Creative Philly, PHILLY.com. And check out the experiential kits. Check out Creative Shway, which is all about creative inspiration and guidance. And for Express Yourself Publishing, there's so many multi-author book opportunities. So I would love to chat with you so much. Everybody's creative. Everybody has a voice, everybody has an expression, and I can't wait to meet you. Thank you so much for taking this hour to listen to our stories and share the energy, and I wish you a wonderful morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you are in this world. Bye, everybody.